Denver Gabriel program. You are cleared for departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
Your 50,000 watt sports leader in Fresno, the Central Valley, and for Giants fans now blaming this program for Giants losses on Wednesdays. I understand how it all works. 940 ESPN, 940 ESPN Fresno.com. Your less than 2 hour tour begins right now, 6 minutes 28 seconds past the hour of 4 p.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time. Days are getting shorter, if you've noticed yet. I'm the host of the program, Christopher Gabriel. Delighted to be with you this afternoon. Russ out today. He'll be back, I believe he'll be back tomorrow. Technical director, producer of the program today, my man Bobby, also a Giants fan, soccer guy. He'll keep us going in the right direction, keep us on the rails. If you want to weigh in during the program, 844-940-3776. You can also follow me on Twitter. You can tweet the program anytime that you like, at CG Program, CG Program. And you can email the program, CGP at 940ESPNFresno.com. On the program today, we are expecting a visit from Marty Lenz. He joins us every week. We have been unable to get him. He might be, just because he might be driving home from KOA News Radio in Denver, he may be in the mountains. He may not be able to reach us or vice versa. So we'll get to him sooner or later. We think we'll get to him sooner or later. Top five at five. Don't be that guy. No, not don't be that guy. Awkward press conference moments. No, don't be that guy. It's Wednesday. What's wrong with me? You know, I'm thrown a little bit for a loop because, you know, whenever we start later and I look up and I don't see 3:00 something, I see 4:00 something, and then I'm thinking, no, it's Thursday, no, it's Wednesday, no, it's Thursday, no, it is Wednesday. Wednesday is don't be that guy. Maybe don't be that guy, don't be me. Don't be me. I'm the guy that can't figure out what day it is. So just your fearless leader from 3 to 6, or today 4:08 to about 6:00. And then I'm really looking forward to my guest at 5:35. Tori Lindley is the president of the National Athletic Trainers Association, and he's also the Senior Associate Athletic Director for Health, Safety, and Performance at Northwestern University. And they came out with a survey recently, and this is going to be the kickoff point of where we're going to be discussing, or what we're going to be discussing today. What they found was 19%, and this is a big number, 19% of the college athletic trainers, we're not talking about trainers now, but athletic trainers, 19% of the many who responded from colleges across the nation, 19% of college athletic trainers reported that a coach played an athlete who was deemed medically out of participation. In other words, this athlete, male or female, was coming back from an injury, had not quite finished rehab yet, or was not quite at the level yet of being able to be out and about on a basketball court, volleyball, football, whatever the case may be. And this is a topic that's come up in my program a number of times over the years, just talking about athletes and rehab and getting rushed back. And we've usually talked about it from the standpoint of college athletes or high school athletes, and how the pressure goes up exponentially from, we're not going to talk so much about in middle school, but going up exponentially from high school to college and then to professional. Professional's a little bit different, obviously. You're talking about guys making millions. You're talking about guys in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. If it's a rookie contract, you know, somebody drafted or a free agent contract, or somebody drafted in a later round in the National Football League, and it's a different situation. But high school wise and college wise, it's something where, as a family member, especially if you're a parent of a college athlete, you want to know you're giving your son or your daughter away to a school for ostensibly 4 years, unless you're going to be somebody who is some elite athlete that's looking to go pro, depending upon the sport, in a year or in a couple of years. And you are entrusting that that university, that head coach, all of the other coaches, and especially the athletic trainers, the athletic training staff, the nutrition staff. You're entrusting them with the health of your son or your daughter, or both in some cases, and you are expecting them to take care of them. You go on recruiting visits, and what you'll hear from coaches, what you'll hear from everybody that's in your living room, is that, you know, we're gonna be dad away from home, or mom, as it were, away from home. And what you just start discovering is that it's not always that way. And you know, you're very well familiar with the well-documented case of Jordan McNair, the football player, the lineman for University of Maryland, who was, by varying accounts, run ragged, run too much on a hot day in training, and reportedly from players who had spoken to those investigating, was getting berated by the head coach, getting berated by athletic trainers that he wasn't working hard enough, and to get his, you know, bleep, bleep, bleep butt up off the ground, and he eventually got rushed to the hospital. He got rushed to the hospital about 45 minutes later than he should have. He ended up dying of heat stroke. It's a terrible story. Just a terrible story. And thankfully, that's not the norm. But obviously, from this survey, from these results, this is something that happens more often than it should. So we'll talk to Tori Lindley at 5:35. One more thing coming up at 5:55. Bobby joining me again, as he did yesterday. Bobby, a couple of things on my mind. We're not able to get a hold of Marty yet. We'll keep trying. A couple of things on my mind, and I'm going to talk about this a little bit. I put a tweet out about this earlier. You're a big soccer guy.
I am.
Okay.
Love me some soccer.
Yeah, and you're a big soccer guy. Have you been surprised, and there's been a lot of stories about this, Dan Wetzel, terrific writer, he's the guy who covered did the majority of coverage for Yahoo, a colleague of our friend Mike Oz. He did the majority of the coverage of the federal corruption trial for college basketball in New York. He was there pretty much every day for every trial. Well, he's also been over in France covering the Women's World Cup, and he had a rather compelling and I think troubling article that I retweeted, saying that this is the main event for women's soccer in the world, the main event every 4 years, and you have what is going to be the match that everybody wanted to see. It's a quarterfinal match, but it's the match everybody wanted to see. The United States against host country France. And a couple of things about this, Bobby. Number one, they're not going to be doing the semifinals or the final in Paris. It's going to be in Lyon, I believe, which is shocking to me. Paris has 12.5 million people. I know there's a big-time team in where they're going to be playing, but it's not Paris. And number two, and what you're hearing not only from Dan Wetzel but from others, is that you would never know there was a major world-stage soccer tournament going on. Do you have any ideas, any theories as to why that is, why FIFA is not promoting this the way they should?
Well, in my opinion, if you don't know the World Cup's going on, where you been? I mean, Fox Sports is doing a great job covering it, and everybody's looking forward to USA versus France tomorrow, and that's going to be, it should be the final. A lot of people think whoever wins that game is going to win the whole thing, go on and be World Cup champions. But, yeah, I think a lot of the headlines are centered around VAR, video assistant referee, when it should be focused around the female athletes and what they're doing on the field. And the fact that VAR is being used for the first time in the World Cup is shocking to me as well.
Well,
that's the biggest stage.
And it's, you know, what you said, it's World Cup. If you don't know about the World Cup, where are you? Isn't that part of the problem that you have FIFA? This is their, I mean, this is a major, this is it. This is the top of the food chain for women's soccer. And you have tremendous elite-level athletes who are there. You have the powerhouse United States team. You have France. You have this epic match that's going to be on Friday night. And you're going to probably have a 50-50 crowd there because the United States fans have traveled superbly to France. I mean,
they have.
There's tens of thousands have been there. It's great to see.
Yeah, they're selling out their matches for sure.
Yeah, so you're going to have this epic quarterfinal match in the host country's stadium in the main city and one of the most spectacular cities in the world, Paris, City of Lights. You're probably going to have a 50-50 crowd, and you're going to have a higher collection of the world's best women's soccer players on that pitch, on that field that night than anywhere in the world the next 4 years because it's the best of the best. And yet there's no billboards. They were talking about in Russia when the World Cup was there. Everywhere you went, you saw billboards. You saw advertisements. You saw everything you needed to see to remind you that the World Cup was going on, but you're not seeing this in France. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I don't know what to make of it. I think they're making a huge mistake. And as far as the game goes tomorrow, it's kind of a bummer that it's at 12 o'clock because it's right in the middle of a work day, but
yeah.
I think they should just make it a holiday. We should just have tomorrow off. We should rally behind the women's team because it's going to be the best match of the tournament so far.
No question.
I'm all for that.
Yeah.
No work. Watch the game.
Do you want to handicap the match a little bit? Do you have an idea who's going to win this? Break this down for me because you are a soccer guy.
I think it's going to be close, and I think USA scores early to kind of take the pressure off. I think France will respond. And final score, I'm going to go USA 3, France 2.
Okay. That seems reasonable to me. I think USA is going to win. I don't know that I have a breakdown quite like that because, again, I know a number of the players on the team, but I don't, you know, I'm not sure what France's offensive capability is. I think the United States is a better defensive team. I think that they're better. Their goalkeeper is better. But I think the United States depth is better. Whomever the U.S. decides to bring in for their three substitutes at whatever point during the game, they're going to be better than what France has. Their depth is just better.
Yeah, no question about it. USA's coach has done a great job managing minutes so far this World Cup, and every game you look at the starting lineup, it's been different because they have so many. They have an embarrassment of riches. They have so many good players, and I think that's going to go a long way, especially as we move forward in the tournament. And the turnarounds get shorter. You only had, 3 days between this last game? So you need depth and numbers, and that's going to help them.
Absolutely. All right. Coming up, talk a little bit more. Either we haven't been able to track Marty down yet. That's okay. Sometimes it happens. You know, sometimes you live radio, that's what happens. As I said, he's in the mountains, and whenever we can't get him, that's usually what happens. We'll keep trying to get a hold of him, but I got a couple of things on my mind about the San Francisco Giants. We'll get to them coming up as well, and you can always weigh in on the program, 844-940-3776. You can tweet me at CG Program. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN. Giving up and giving in, tell me, in this house of mine. Nothing ever comes without a consequence of cost, tell me, will the stars align? Will heaven step in, will it save us from our sin, will it? Cause this house of mine stands strong. That's the price you pay. Leave behind your heart.
Coming on a little bit late today, San Francisco Giants, Colorado Rockies, Oracle Park. Rockies win 6-3. It was a game the Giants led early and then gave up a grand slam, which basically changed the entire game. Didn't know, heard this stat after the game, that the Colorado Rockies, either in Candlestick or at AT&T, Pac Bell, And now Oracle, you know, I'm reversing those a little bit. But they've never, until today, they had never hit a Grand Slam homer in that park. Interesting story. We've not been able to reach Marty, so I always, you know, because Marty is as reliable as the sun rising in the east every day. But I haven't been able to reach him, so hopefully nothing in the way of car trouble or anything like that or something worse has happened. So we will just, we'll see if he gives us a call. But normally he is pretty darn reliable. So we will just continue to move forward. The NBA, you may have heard this, the NBA is formally exploring introducing what would amount to a reduced regular season schedule in 2021-2022, in the 21-22 season for their 75th anniversary of the NBA. You had what amounted to a broad think tank, a dozen team executives from both the basketball and business operations side, and what they did was they discussed what that kind of a season would look like. And it's the first time that anybody can remember, either with Adam Silver or his predecessor, David Stern, ever talking about having a season where you decide to effectively plan out that you're going to play less games. And the number that was in, I just don't believe it'll happen, because there's a couple of different plans that they're talking about. But one of the plans that they're looking at is for a season that has 58 games. So the league is what, 30 teams? So each team would play the other 29 teams, you'd play them twice. That's you're talking a 24-game difference. They are also talking about having what amounts to what they do in a lot of other countries, a mid-season tournament, a mid-season cup, as it were. And I don't know, NBA fans aren't used to that. I think the concept here is not only based on the kinds of things you see in European soccer, but it also sounds like the kind of thing that you see in November, not maybe not November, but in December, more December in college basketball, where you have all these tournaments, all these classics, and that's one of the things that they're actually looking at. Another thing that they're looking at is a play-in, a play-in type scenario. I don't know if that would extend over to the playoffs in terms of how certain teams got in. Not really sure, but you talk about the postseason grind for teams like the Golden State Warriors in the past, the Bulls, the Celtics, the Lakers. But you look at what it is now. Cleveland Cavaliers certainly faced that as well. And during the 5-year run to the NBA Finals for the Golden State Warriors, during those 5 years where they won 3 titles out of those 5 years, they played an extra 105 games. So that's a season and some playoffs. I mean, that's, or if you want to look at it from regular season, a season and a quarter, essentially. Basically, what that amounts to is 10 extra months of playing time. And, I mean, I guess there's no way to attach one to the other, but I think that you could at least look at that and say the wear and tear on their bodies going deep 5 straight years, being the last team standing for 3 of those 5 years, but being in the final series in all 5 of those years, those extra 105 games eventually caught up with them. And the counter to that is, well, it caught up to Kevin Durant. Or it caught up, Kevin Durant wasn't there for all those years, but it caught up to Kevin Durant over the last couple of years. It caught up to Klay Thompson. The counter is, well, it didn't really catch up to anybody else, but you can look at the kinds of nicks and bruises and bumps and strains and what have you that this team had. I don't know if there's been a progression over time, but it at least makes the argument, or at least starts to make the argument, that maybe that extra wear and tear was leaving 1, 2, 3 or more guys far more susceptible to injury simply because of the wear and tear. I mean, I don't think that's that much of a stretch. So I put a poll up on Twitter today. I was just curious to see where people were at, and I simply said, would you be in favor of a shorter NBA season, meaning a reduction in regular season games? And I gave 3 options. 1, yes, 82 is too many. 2, no, 82 works. 3, shorten every pro league. We'll keep this up until tomorrow. Right now, 50% of people responding say yes, 82 is too many games. 31% saying no, that 82% works just fine. 19% are saying shorten every pro league. So, Bobby, we've talked about this on the program, as I said, a number of times, and you're going to get an argument from owners or governors in the NBA, as they're called now. You're going to get this argument that says there's going to be tremendous loss of revenue. There's going to be a loss of revenue for NBA governors. There's going to be loss of revenue for players. There's going to be ramifications to television contracts with ESPN, with TNT, with local deals and local broadcast deals. And my argument to that is that's true, but it's not going to be losing money per se. It's simply going to be making less. And there is a distinction there because all of these ownership groups, these governorships, if we're supposed to call them that now, all of those are making money hand over fist. The only question here is how much money they make.
No question about it. You're spot on. I mean, we're talking millions and millions of dollars that those games would generate that they're not going to have potentially. And I don't know about you, Christopher, but I never think, oh, the NBA season is too long. I love the NBA. Same thing with football. I never think when I'm sitting there Saturday, Sunday, I'm like, man, I wish this was longer. I love football. So, I don't know. But I do get the fact that it is really hard on their bodies.
I am a little bit the other way from you. I would start with baseball. For me, 162 is too much. I love all these sports. I love hockey. But for me, I think about the hockey, the strike shortened or the lockout shortened season, when the regular season ended up, instead of being 82 games, being more on the order of something like 58 or 60 games. And suddenly, the players, it was so clear on the ice. They were dialed in more. The games meant more. It's not that the games don't mean enough now, but there was a heightened sense of urgency right off the bat when the NHL players came back. We've seen this in other sports before. In basketball, I get dialed in for basketball, but I love the NBA, but I get more dialed in when we get to the playoffs. And I wouldn't mind seeing a shorter regular season if for no other reason than to help these guys' bodies out because they're playing so many games a week. There's so much travel. There's so much pounding their legs are taking, their knees are taking, that I've got to believe that it's bound to help them out. You mentioned football. This is a tricky collective bargaining situation because the NFL Players Association is probably the most aggressive and the most combative of the players' unions of the four professional team sports in this country. And I know that they've been talking about getting rid of two preseason games, but adding two regular season games. And, Bobby, I just wonder, I love football too. It's my favorite sport. I just wonder how many professional football players, especially guys who are getting beaten up every game, running backs, wide receivers who are getting hit all the time, the guys who are taking the pounding, well, pretty much everybody, I guess what I'm saying. How are they going to feel if you're suddenly adding two regular season games? And the answer from Roger Goodell, cutting out two preseason games, most of these guys who are starters are not playing more than a couple of minutes in these games anyway. So how do you think they would feel?
Well, I think if the money was right, they would be all for it.
Think about CTE and concussions.
Right. I think if maybe their health care was improved once they retire, if they're guaranteed their families and themselves are taken care of health care-wise, they might be more for it. But it's going to have to be pretty substantial for them for the Players Association to agree to an extended season. But I like the preseason idea. We don't need four games. We can cut that down to two at most two more.
What does college football do for preseason games? There are none.
None.
I don't think the pros would need any. I like when they have scrimmages, when the Cleveland Browns are scrimmaging the Bengals, when the Raiders are scrimmaging the 49ers or the Cowboys, wherever the teams happen to be. The Bears, sometimes they used to scrimmage the Packers or they used to scrimmage the Chiefs in Wisconsin when they were there. I kind of like that. I don't, I'm not going to pay any amount of money to go see a preseason game.
Right. I just don't see the benefit of having preseason in general.
No, I don't either. And then you talked about, see, that's a whole other hour, talking about health care after guys retire. Because Cam Worrell and I have talked about this on the program before, that you look at some of the players where players will come out and they'll say that they feel like they've been abandoned for
right.
all of the physical abuse that they've taken over the course of their careers, where the average NFL career is something like 3.4, 3.9. I don't think it's more than 4 years. If it's more than four, it's not much than four. You know, we're not talking about guys doing 15-year careers like the NBA. And their health care, whatever it is, however it's set up, should be better because of the pounding they take.
No question about it. And I've heard you say it. I've heard Tony say it. What does the NFL stand for? Not for long.
Not for long.
They don't last very long. And
they don't. No, absolutely right. All right. More coming up. Lots of things that we can talk about here and lots of things that I'd actually like to talk about here. One of the things I want to talk about coming up is the, let's just call it the unscheduled meet and greet with Cody Bellinger in games on Sunday and Monday. A lot of folks had a lot of funny ideas about that, and they were making jokes on social media, on Twitter and on Facebook, but there's a different side of this that hasn't really been discussed, and I'm going to take you back about 16, 17 years to discuss that side of it and then run it forward to Cody Bellinger. Glad you're hanging out with us. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Coming up in hour number three, which is actually hour number two today, top five at five, Don't Be That Guy. And then Tori Lindley, president of the National Athletic Trainers Association. Lots of stuff to talk about with him. Really looking forward to having him join the program. All right. So you are very much aware of the fact that a couple of Dodgers games in a row, it was the Dodgers playing the Diamondbacks, and there were a couple of games in a row that a young lady came on the field, and two different games, and they greeted him, kind of a little bit of a meet and greet for him. And you know, we all laughed at it, we all joked about it, what have you, but I want to take you back to Chicago, a couple of different incidents, one that happened in September of 2002, and then the next one happening in April of 2003. But before we do that, we have tracked them down, we've searched far and wide, and we think we have this gentleman.
The Mountain West Conference has never been the same since this former wide receiver graduated from Colorado State. He holds the all-time season and career reception marks for... Wait. Sorry, no. That was a different receiver. Never mind then. Here's Marty Lenz.
You know, my News Talk days, we would be starting a program, and then I'd have somebody in studio. Sometimes it was maybe a United States senator, or it might be a diplomat from the United Nations, or I would be live in Jerusalem, and then suddenly something would happen at 90 seconds into it, and we'd have to just drop all that and go to it. That's the kind of power that Marty Lenz has on this program. We've tracked him down, and we have found him. How are you, my friend?
I am fine. Sorry about that. I got in some sort of cell zone, and I saw you calling. I couldn't get out, so please forgive me.
No worries. That's what we figured. I was worried that maybe, you know, there was car trouble or something worse, so I'm glad you're okay. Perfect time to come out of the cell zone, though, Marty. This is the story, and I'll just set it up this way for you. So Cody Bellinger, in back-to-back games, gets greeted by a woman out on the field. The security comes out, and they treat the woman both times better than they treat men when they come out there, which is, I think it's a good thing. But we all laughed and joked, and lots of people joked on social media. But going back to 2002, you had the father and the son that came out of the stands at then Comiskey Park and attacked first base coach for the Kansas City Royals, Tom Gamboa. I mean, we're beating him until players came out there, security came out there. I mean, it was this weird delayed reaction before they came out and to get those two guys off there. And by the way, I saw an interview with, I think, The Sun, and just to talk about a dirtbag, he's still proud. That was the word he used, proud of his attack. Yeah, we're happy for him. Yeah. And then the following season, Marty, you had first base umpire Laz Diaz again in a Royals-White Sox game, turns to look at a fly ball, and a fan comes out and attacks him, although he served in the Marine Corps Reserve. And Diaz had no problems taking this fan and basically slamming him to the ground. And other players were looking to get involved and try to take him out as well. Everybody was very much aware of what happened there. But that brings me back to Cody Bellinger and the two women that came out. And again, Marty, is this a problem? This has been going on for ages, right? In sports, fans run out on the field. But in this era that we're in now, where danger seems to lurk at a much more heightened level, should baseball be looking, and other sports, but in particular baseball, be looking at this a little bit more stringently and in terms of when a fan comes running on the field?
Well, do you remember, was it Morgana, the kissing bandit,
yes,
back in the 70s and 80s at Dodgers games that did that and came out, and everybody thought it was kind of cute and funny and somewhat innocuous and safe? Maybe this young woman, I would equate that, and it's maybe not fair because player safety regardless, you don't know if that person has a knife, a gun, or whatever else wants to do harm or do damage. You know, ironically, maybe this is another reason why you have protective netting.
Yeah.
That way it's a little harder and you see people there. You don't have to worry about the foul balls. You worry about the kooks that come out in the stands. I just think like anything else, I think when you're that close to the proximity of the field, and again, I don't have a problem with that, you just have to be a little more aware of some of the security measures you have in place. I know some of the yellow coats and some of those ushers, you know, some of them are older gentlemen. You know, my dad wanted to usher, you know, when he was in his late 50s and 60s and he was capable. But, I mean, how somebody that age may be going to, you know, be able to fend off somebody like that potentially. So I think they have to look at it seriously. You know, I don't necessarily think there's a way you overreact to this. But at the same time, you just say, look, man, you can't be on the field for a variety of reasons. Even if it's totally innocuous and you want to do something silly like Morgana did or something else, you just can't be there. It's too much of a risk, and the players shouldn't have to worry about that kind of nuttiness going on. They should be able to, you know, focus on the game and basically provide everybody else the entertainment they're seeking, which is a ball game. So, I think this is something you have to seriously address. Each stadium, kind of like the netting thing, has to come up with a policy of saying this isn't going to happen and police it that way, or get people down there lower where people have access to the field that are true bodyguards that, you know, if you step over the line, you're going to pay the penalty and pay the price.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I completely agree. And I think the safety netting that is being talked about that would go from the end of the dugout, scaled down or cascading down to the foul poles, that will do a much better job of blocking fans. I mean, coming over an outfield wall in a lot of stadiums is much more risky. If you do that at Wrigley Field, you have to get into the fence, into the netting, and then climb over that little metal fence, and then you're dropping about a good 14 feet down to the field. So
lazy. At the very least, you can see them when they're doing it because it's like they're trying
exactly
to do it. You can see them before they get on the field. Yeah.
By the way, a follow-up, and this was all over the place today, the young girl that was hit in the head by the line drive in Minute Maid Park, the Cubs' Albert Almero Almora Jr., we have learned, she's 2 years old, we have learned that she suffered a skull fracture, she had a seizure, she had subdural bleeding, she had brain contusions, and she had brain edema. She's taking medication to stop the seizures while she is still recovering at home. She is supposed to recover, again, I put this out on Twitter today, Marty, and I'm going to revisit it for a couple of minutes with you. Give me a reason. I already know you can't because you're on the same side of this as I am. Give me a reason why the baseball owners of America, every single baseball owner, hasn't signed their name to a joint statement saying we are going to get new safety netting that's up towards the foul poles. As far whatever we have to do, we're going to get this up ASAP. What is the delay? What is the holdup?
Well, I can't give you a reason, but I'll counter by saying the reason they should, if you don't give a crud about the people that you should, the people that pay the patrons and help pay to support the club, You got to worry about this lawsuits and the pocketbooks. And I don't care. And we talked to an attorney about this. Even though on the back of the ticket it says you assume risk, you can't sign away your rights. You, in this country, that's the one thing about it. You can sign whatever, do whatever. You can't sign away your rights, because what you're doing is you're basically saying, well, we can have this open-air park, but it's totally on you. Yeah, there's a certain fan responsibility, but if you really want to eliminate any lawsuits or like that, you do it because you don't want to get – because somebody's going to sue. Someone's going to pay for that girl one way or another, whether it's a lawsuit, insurance, something like that. So if you're just – if you're purely taking the emotion out of it and the safety – think of the fiscal end of it that you have to do, because otherwise it's going to cost a ball, you know, a ball team money, a ball club money. And that's just stupid. It's bad business just from the optics for fandom. But it's bad business that you wouldn't do something, everything you can do to protect your fan base. So purely just thinking of the money piece, I'd do it because I don't want to get sued.
Well,
because again, this is such a simple solution.
Yeah.
That's the thing that drives me. It's a simple solution that they could invest and do it, make it safe, and then you eliminate probably 90%, 95% of these kind of injuries from ever happening.
Well, the disclaimers that you see on tickets, I talked to an attorney about this some time back, and I talked about it from when I lived in New York City. It was after I lived in New York City, and you see the car garages, and you see them everywhere. The sign that says, not responsible for lost or stolen objects. Well, a friend of mine in Long Island had his car stolen from a lot, and the company's owner tried to go to war with his attorney and what have you, saying that we're not responsible. That lasted about a day in court. The company that had the garage had to, beyond what the insurance cost was, the company was responsible. And what I learned from that particular attorney was, in many cases, I don't know, you can't say all, but in many cases, that little disclaimer is not going to cover it.
Yeah, oh no, and of course not, especially when it comes to loss of life and limb is a phrase that you hear a lot about too. And absolutely, you just can't. And the thing is, I think what the court will look at it and say, this is so freaking preventable. This is stupid it's even here in the first place. And even though judges are supposed to be impartial, they see a little girl like that suffering and going through that and saying, and this could have prevented because you either didn't want to or ignorant to provide a few grand in netting to go a little further down. There you go, a rule for the plaintiff. You lose. You lose.
Right.
So it's just stupid, because again, this is preventable. This isn't somebody, if you want to say, falling off a stadium because they're drunk and something like that. This is somebody in the confines of the park, within the rules of the park, that gets hit with the foul ball. And we talked about this on the air. No one pays attention down there. Children, adults, anything. Should they be more engaged? 100%. There's always a certain amount of responsibility you have when you're in those environs. But also, when you're at a place that doesn't do everything it can to protect you as a patron and as a customer, then that falls on them. And this is where that gets to. Baseball, or the clubs that aren't doing this right now, are not doing enough to make the game safe for the fans. And that, no judge, with his salt, will look in and say, this is wrong, because this is so easy to take care of and solve. And again, I said this before, this is a will issue. This is not a skill issue.
Right. One more segment coming up. It's a truncated Marty Lenz appearance today. We're going to talk about the NCAA. They have come out with they're going to be changing, or have changed, transfer guidelines in terms of limiting immediate eligibility. A lot of what's at the root of this is the NCAA's fear that college student athletes are desirous of essentially turning college sports into college free agency. I've never agreed with that for a second. We'll get Marty's thoughts on this coming up next. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
A couple more minutes with Marty Lenz. Today, tonight, going on right now, Michigan-Vanderbilt in the College World Series final. Both teams have won a game, and it's 1-1 right now. Looks like it's the bottom of the third. I can't quite tell from the TV. It's across the room. But one thing I can tell, even though Marty, in the last couple of years, they've been setting attendance records in Omaha. Of course, this isn't Rosenblatt, which seated 15,000 for years. It ended up getting expanded a little bit to 18,000. This park seats 24,000, has the ability to expand to 35. But I can tell you, in the bleachers tonight, there's a ton of empty seats, and this is far from sold out. I don't blame anything but the fact that I don't think people are as excited or as intrigued with Michigan and Vanderbilt as some of the other matchups. I just think that college baseball is incredibly popular. I've been to Omaha at Rosenblatt. It's a blast. And at Rosenblatt, you usually weren't able to get a seat, but there's a lot of empty seats. Any thought why that might be tonight?
It could be that, because at least in Michigan, what, the last time they were in the College World Series, 1962 or something like that? It's a Big Ten team. We're not probably used to seeing the traditional. I mean,
Years for a Big Ten team. That was Ohio State. They haven't been there, I think, since the early 80s.
Right. So, I mean, it's been a long time, because it's just, obviously, it's not a place you think of baseball when it comes to college. So maybe that, but I also think this, too. I mean, to me, the season, all these seasons seem to get longer and longer.
Yeah.
And maybe if the season's a little hustled up and quicker, and maybe if it's done, I don't know, mid-June, maybe that helps a little bit, too, because I do think at some point you get sports fatigue.
Well,
everything else that's on right now, you probably lose a little bit of interest in viewership.
Forgive my interrupting, because I want to get to something else, but you just hit on something, Marty, that before we were able to get to, that was something that we talked about. I'm right there with you. We were talking about sports seasons, the NBA talking about maybe in 21-22 going to a 58-game schedule to honor the 75th anniversary and doing some other different things in the season. I think that all sports could stand to have a little bit of a shorter season. Unfortunately, we have a lot of very greedy people that are running these that will try to tell folks we're going to lose money. You're not losing money. You're just not making as much. You're not losing any money. But
I think you dilute the product. You remember, scarcity is good. A little less of something makes it more interesting.
Yeah.
Than having more of something because you're making a money grab. To me, keep it special, keep it premium, maybe charge a little higher rates versus diluting it out with extra games and playoffs and everything else. Scarcity's good, and I think it's one of those things. The season gets long, it just fatigues, and then you have other options, other choices, other things. Nothing against college baseball. It's kind of cool, but I'd sit and rather watch a major league game. Personally, of all the college sports, college baseball probably interests me the least. But it doesn't mean I don't value it and I don't respect the kids, but it's just one of those things. It's getting into the whole other cavalcade of sports, especially with Major League Baseball, and people just get tired. They get tired after a while.
Yeah, no, it's not a knock on college baseball. I mean, everybody has a favorite sport, and if you list your sports, some sports going to be at the bottom of the weather ones that you're looking at. And I enjoy college baseball, but am I going to watch that more than I'm going to watch college football, college basketball, or for that matter, from where I grew up, college hockey? No, definitely not.
Yeah.
Right. One thing I want to get to here in our remaining couple of minutes, in 2018, so the NCAA adopted a new standard that was going to allow student athlete waivers that were going to be granted on a case by case basis, and the language was if an athlete could show documented mitigating circumstances outside of that athlete's control and directly impacts the health, safety, or well-being of the student athlete, there were going to be waivers granted. Well, that language has been updated now, requiring documented, extenuating, extraordinary, and mitigating circumstances outside of the student-athlete's control that directly impacts the health, safety, or well-being of the student-athlete. Extenuating and extraordinary are the key words there. And to make a very, very big topic a little bit shorter to fit into a couple of minutes, the NCAA is trying to, and in fact doing it, tightening transfer guidelines. Even though the transfer portal was a big thing this year, it's not that many more transfers were granted, but there were a lot more transfers of student-athletes wanting to transfer. Marty, I'm still not buying the idea that student athletes wanting to transfer is going to turn into wild, wanton free agency.
No, what they don't like it that they're losing control. That's really what it is. Now that the kids have options, and now that they have a little more power, I'll say the kids and the parents, now the NCAA doesn't like that because they want to have control of everything. And actually, what I think this does, even take the competitive piece out of it, I think now this changes the dynamic where, to some degree, and this is my phrasing, that these kids aren't indentured servants to these schools just because contracts can be broken. Scholarships are given on a year-to-year basis anymore. Coaches can leave and come. And I think you need to give kids the power and the flexibility to say, hey, I came to play for this guy or I came to play for this system. That doesn't mean I can't suck it up and still stay here to honor my commitment. But why am I held to a higher standard than these coaches that make tens of millions of dollars? That's the thing that I think rubs me wrong about it. And the NCAA, they're supposed to be about the students. They're siding with the universities and they're siding with the coaches. They're on the wrong side of this. And so they're trying to put that genie back in the bottle. But you're right. This is not going to lead to mass migration and all this change of free, making NCAA free agency. It's giving kids a choice. It's given them an opportunity. And I bet you, if you look at the data, most of these kids are usually seniors or they've graduated and they want a new opportunity. Why shouldn't they be afforded that?
Well, I agree completely. And a lot of times it isn't extenuating and extraordinary circumstances or mitigating circumstances that are impacting a student's health or safety or well-being. Marty, sometimes it's a student gets there and they're in the community and you know what? They don't like the town they're in. They don't like the academic program they're in. They don't like something. They should have the ability to transfer no different than any other student.
100%. Yeah, because things change. You go for one thing and then it changes. Why should you be held up to a higher end of the bargain than the people that made the bargain with you?
Absolutely. You know, it's like getting to the buffet late and some of the items are gone, but you still have some of them. A little bit of Marty is better than no Marty at all. Marty Lenz, KOA News Radio. Glad that we hooked up. Glad there was nothing wrong. My friend, we'll talk next week.
Hey, thank you for your patience. We will. Take care.
Always for you, my friend. Coming up, hour number three. This is the CGP.
The Top 5 at 5 is sponsored by the Law Office of Josh Lazar and Associates. And now, from Fresno, California, to the furthest reaches of the galaxy, here are your Top 5 at 5 sports talkers of the day.
Top 5 at 5, this is hour number 3. It's really hour number 2, beginning right now. It's very complicated sometimes. We come on at 4:07 because of the Giants. You know, the Giants push us back sometimes. We're okay with that. They're going to take precedence over this program. The least they can do, Robert, the least they can do is win the darn baseball game.
Wouldn't that be nice?
How about that?
They can't do it.
I've been bugging John Miller. It's like, you know, you push me back, Johnny. Come on. Can you win the baseball games? Well, you know, top 5 at 5, five stories that you've either heard during the course of the day or you're aware of them, but Mr. Bobby and myself will give you a little bit of a longer take.
Number one.
All right. So the Toronto Raptors have confirmed that Marc Gasol has exercised his $25.6 million option for the 2019-2020 season. He's going to remain in Toronto. We're so used to hearing player after player after player either let us know that they are not exercising their option, they're opting out as opposed to opting in because they're going to test the waters, doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to leave that team, but they're looking to get a better contract somewhere. And in many cases, in every case, the team that they're on is the team that's going to be able to give them the most money in terms of a max deal. Max, it's just going to be superior to any other team. Question is, who's going to pay it? Is that team going to pay it? Do they want to stay on that team? Do they want to find a team that's going to be more to their liking, a city that's more to their liking, teammates, a combo platter that's more to their liking? So, Bobby, Marc Gasol saying that he's okay with 25.6 mil. That's going to be okay for him. It's, you know, he's not going to need to opt out for anything. He's good with that. The obvious question here is Marc Gasol enough of a draw on that roster that has Lowry and Van Vliet and Danny Green and just some talented players, Serge Ibaka? Is this enough of a draw to have any bearing on what Kawhi Leonard's going to do?
It certainly helps. I think a combination of everything that you said, all the supporting pieces, the fact that he can get the most money from Toronto, and he's in the East. I mean, why would you want to go to a team in the West when it's loaded with talent, and teams 1 through 8 in the West are going to be hard to, you know, it's hard to get into the playoffs. In the East, you've got Giannis, you've got the Sixers, who you don't know about, so I think it helps.
Yeah,
I think he should stay there.
Yeah. Derek emailing, I don't have a contract, I'm just exercising. Thank you for weighing in, Derek. Appreciate that. CGP at 940ESPNFresno.com. He's right on it. And it's in many ways, Bobby, it is the same methodology that LeBron employed. You know, he was in Cleveland. He went to Miami. Obviously, there were other circumstances involved, hanging out with his buddy Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh, part of it, and they, you know, they win a title or two. You know, it was a great threesome there. He goes back to his hometown, but he's in the East this whole time. He comes out here, different stuff happens and what have you. But if you're Kawhi, you've got to be thinking. You see Boston with Kyrie Irving going to likely depart Boston, or at least that's what we think right now. Al Horford, he has said he's not going to opt in. He will possibly depart Boston. The Sixers, as you said, is Jimmy Butler going to be a Sixer next year? I'm guessing no. That would be my guess. You look at that conference right now, Milwaukee is the biggest obstacle. You've shown you can beat them. Giannis and that team is just going to get better and better. But Kawhi, it's an easier road. I think it's an easier road, easier is relative, to get out of that conference. And also, you're a national hero, man.
Yeah, he is.
You know, so with Gasol staying, it seems like it would help a little bit.
I think so, too.
Number two.
Well, as long as we're on this NBA topic, let's just stay with the NBA. We've talked about guys opting in or opting out. Here's a guy who is opting out. Here's a guy who has declined $31.5 million and will become an unrestricted free agent. Of course, I am talking about, in Jeopardy style, who is Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant. Thank you. His business manager, Rich Kleiman, told general manager Bob Myers of the decision the last couple of days. They're all out there together in New York. They've been talking about free agency options. Is it any coincidence that they are in New York? Well, you decide. The thought has been the Knicks or the Nets or the L.A. Clippers. I just don't see Kevin Durant going to the L.A. Clippers. I just don't see it happening. I think if he goes anywhere, I know that he's talked about wanting to join his buddy. It seems like everybody wants to join Kyrie, but we'll see what happens. I've said it on this program probably 8 or 9 times, if not more. I know the Brooklyn Nets are better positioned right now to make a run. They're not going anywhere. They're not winning the NBA championship next year or probably the year after. Certainly not next year with an injured Kevin Durant. They have a better roster top to bottom right now on paper than the Knicks. But if you've lived in New York, if you've been to New York, you understand. If you understand basketball history, Barclays Center is a beautiful place. It's not that old. It's gorgeous. It's right across the East River in Brooklyn. It's not the Garden.
No, it's not. It doesn't compare.
No, it's like trying to compare going to a bowl game, going to Sun Devil Stadium for the Fiesta Bowl, that's fun. Going to the Mercedes-Benz Dome for the Sugar Bowl, that's fun. Going to Hard Rock Stadium for the Orange Bowl, that's fun too. None of those are the Rose Bowl. You go to the Rose Bowl once and you realize it's a whole different level of spectacle with the, you know, with the sun, you know, going down over the San Gabriel, you know, or not over the San Gabriel Mountains, but, you know, shining on the San Gabriel Mountains as it's going down in the Arroyo Seco. It's just a beautiful setting. You got 100,000 people in there, and you're not sitting 5 decks up. You're right there. The difference is as striking playing at Madison Square Garden versus playing really anywhere in the NBA.
Yeah, I would like to see the Knicks get back to relevancy.
Me too.
But these players have all earned their right to, you know, explore free agency and better their working environment, make more money. But for Kevin Durant, he should just stay in Golden State. Why would he leave an A-plus organization, front office, coach, star Steph Curry, who's great to play with? I mean, leave?
You're preaching to the choir here. Let's put it in round numbers. If Kevin Durant wants to go to the Knicks or the Nets or the Clippers, he can sign, assuming they have the max available that they can sign. Durant can sign a 4-year, $164 million dollar deal with a team. That's not my number. That's the number. He can sign a 4-year, $164 million deal with another team. He is eligible. He remains eligible to sign a 5-year, $221 million deal with the Warriors. And you're not really talking about a whole lot of different, differences in money here. Just a quick division. You're looking at a deal with another team of what about $40 million or thereabouts, $41 million. And then if you're looking at the at the Warriors deal at $221 million over 5 years, you're looking at $44 million. So you're talking about a difference of $3 million a year. Not a lot of difference. One organization, as you just said, one of the best organizations in all of professional sports, especially now that they got rid of Mark Stevens after his ridiculous shove of Kyle Lowry. You have an organization that's won three of the past five titles. If they were to keep Durant and keep Klay Thompson, I think they keep Klay Thompson. Steph is there. Draymond's there. If Andre Iguodala continues, this is a team that in 2 years is going to be back as a playoff favorite. You know, and the media, Kevin is not, KD has shown that he is not, what are we looking for? He's got rabbit ears. He hears too much.
He does.
And, you know, he'll get into a one-hour argument with a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old kid in a basement who's wearing, you know, in his underwear and a bathrobe and taped up windows, arguing.
Well, Kevin, on Twitter.
On Twitter. What are you doing, KD? Come on, my man. You don't want to do that. He can go to New York and he's going to get scrutinized by more papers than any time in his career. I don't know why he'd want to do it.
Me neither. I mean, Kyrie Irving and him don't like the media, and they've shown that they don't handle it well. And Golden State, they're moving into a new arena next year in San Francisco. There's another added incentive, in my opinion, to stay put.
I agree. Totally agree.
Number three.
When did you start watching ESPN? I'm asking you, when did you start watching ESPN?
When Stuart Scott was doing his thing and Dan Patrick.
Okay. They started at the roughly similar years.
So Dan 2000-ish?
Patrick, yeah, Dan Patrick started. Dan Patrick was doing sports for CNN for a long time. A lot of people forget that. Bob Lee, 64 years old, Bob Lee has announced that he will retire at the end of this month. Well, that's just a couple of days from now. And you want to talk about a guy that has had the kind of career that everybody envies, no matter what field we're talking about. I don't care what it is. Bob Lee, 40 years there, he signed on, I'm trying to get the exact date. It was September 9th, 1979. To put that in perspective, that was day three of ESPN.
Wow.
So he is, you talk about people like Chris Berman, the late Tom Meese, who was wonderful, Dan Patrick, Keith Olbermann. A lot of people don't like Keith Olbermann because of politics. You just look past it. The work that he did with Dan Patrick as SportsCenter co-anchors, it was the best co-anchor team they've ever had there, hands down. And Bob Lee, his work as on Outside the Lines on ESPN E60, he always, and when he was a SportsCenter anchor, you know, this is a guy who early on, he did the first NCAA selection show. He did the first broadcast NFL draft. So this is a guy who has a varied career. He never went for the quick joke. He didn't go for the corny joke. He was all about, he's like Steve Levy. It's all about business. Very, very affable, very friendly, very disarming guy. The kind of guy that you will sit down with a cup of coffee and you could talk sports for 12 hours with him. To me, one of the most high-quality people in our business.
Yeah, from afar, it seems that way. And if you want to learn something, you just tune into Outside the Lines. He was great. I used to love watching him.
Yeah, and when he took that leave of absence back in October, and you kind of had an idea when he stayed out a little bit longer. It wasn't supposed to be that long. It was going to be like a month, but then another month came on, and then another month. And after a while, it's like, maybe he needs to recharge, or just, you know, he's made enough money.
I mean, he's had a great career.
Yeah,
he's
making millions. I mean, he's doing great, and he's somebody who I'm really going to miss. Same reasons as Bobby mentioned, just a high quality reporter, high quality anchor, and yeah, Outside the Lines, those shows were as good and continue to be as good as anything in sports television.
Number four.
Well, I put a tweet up about this last night, and I used a GIF of a train going across a bridge, and then the bridge collapses and falls into the river, train and all. And I attached it to the story that the Houston Rockets are eyeing a sign and trade for Jimmy Butler. Now, the deal here is the Rockets don't have the salary cap space that they would be able to sign Jimmy Butler. What they need is essentially for him to give a threat that the Sixers are going to lose him. They're going to lose him for nothing to a team with the available room that would then motivate the Sixers into, okay, we're going to sign him, we'll go ahead and do that, and then we'll trade him to you. That's what they're hoping for. That's the idea. Here's my thought. There's already rumored issues. I don't know how true they are. I don't have any way of knowing. I've talked to one writer in Houston who is of the opinion that, well, don't really know, that Chris Paul is not as happy as he could be. When options 1 through 4 in your half-court offense are James Harden, not that Chris Paul has the same skill that he had 5 years ago, but that can't be a good thing. I know that Chris Paul wants to run a set offense. James Harden wants it to be ISO. That he wants it to be isolated place for him. There's already some tension there. Jimmy Butler was the reason that the Chicago Bulls locker room fell apart. He went to Minnesota Timberwolves. We saw the videos of him out by a lake, by a campfire, and he's going to adopt the Minnesota lifestyle. Well, that's great. And then things fell apart there. He didn't like the young kid's attitude on his team. Goes to Philadelphia. It wasn't 3 weeks that we heard there were problems with him and Brett Brown. And the fact that he's even, you know, interested in getting out of there should be all you need to know about his time in Philadelphia with guys like Ben Simmons and so on. I do not see him as a great fit in Houston with Chris Paul and James Harden. I just don't think the leadership on that team, the stability, the emotional stability of that team, the temperature of that locker room, much less when they're on the court, is such that welcoming a guy like Jimmy Butler is going to improve that.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't think it's a great fit, and I think if they were able to pull that off, like you said, they have to bring in a third team, but they're also talking about making Clint Capella available, Eric Gordon, and those are key pieces to the team. Chris Paul is getting older. He doesn't always stay healthy. I just don't think, if I'm Jimmy Butler, I want to go to the Houston Rockets.
I just don't see it. And admittedly, full disclosure, I'm not a huge Jimmy Butler fan from the standpoint of him being the guy that a team gets on his back. So in Houston, he wouldn't have to do that. In Philadelphia, obviously he had other guys there that were very talented and able to make plays, but he was still supposed to be the veteran leader that came in, and he did some good things. There's no question about that. But nobody is going to confuse him as being the kind of dynamic force and game-changing player that is Kawhi Leonard, LeBron James, or Kevin Durant. Russell Westbrook isn't that player. Russell Westbrook gets triple-doubles. Russell Westbrook is as explosive and dynamic as there is in the NBA. But he's also a guy that, you know, he might take 40 shots and go 8 for 40 one night, and he's not helping you. He's rarely going to be a guy that's looking to feed somebody to have them make the big shot of the big play. Russell wants the ball in his hands, and you ain't getting it if he's got it.
Number 5.
Well, we touched on this earlier with Marty Lenz when he was on, the family of the little girl, who was struck by the foul ball. We've got the update. She is 2 years old. Originally, it was reported that she was 4 years old. There was a brief statement to go. I mean, she has a skull fracture, other injuries. There was bleeding. She's had seizures. But the family, as you would imagine, has retained an attorney. There was a brief statement saying the family's foremost concern is about the health of their child. But they also want me to extend their thanks to the fans and the Astros for their concern. And the family is, they are right now looking at, you know, the possibility of a lawsuit. There has not been a lawsuit filed, but attorney Steve Palatko is going to be representing the family this is a direct statement, with an eye toward discussion on potential options in the matter. And it's a tough situation because on the one hand, you are taking on the risk when you're at a baseball game. Number two, the reality is you have a two-year-old girl who has had some serious injuries. And staying alert or not, how is a family going to react at a ball coming between 93 and 100 miles an hour at them? How do they do that? And in a lawsuit, would a lawyer be able to say, if there would have been more preventative measures in place at Minute Maid Park, this wouldn't have happened? You know, you had the woman at Dodger Stadium last year who died 4 days later after getting hit in the head with a ball. And one of the issues here, Bobby, is that it ends up looking like the family, no matter what they do, no matter how many things they say, it looks like they're trying to turn this about money as opposed to their little girl. But maybe the impetus is, no, it's about the safety of other little girls and other little boys and other adults going forward, that this doesn't happen again.
Yeah, it shouldn't happen. And it's just terrible, awful stories when we see stuff like this. I think it's just time. We have to extend the nets because I get it. People will say, oh, you got to bring your mitt to the game. You got to be watching every pitch. But then they're also putting these huge video boards and in-game contests and, you know, they're selling entertainment, so you're going to be distracted no
Absolutely.
Matter what. And we all have cell phones
we
now.
We all got them.
Just extend the nets so this doesn't happen.
Extend the nets. Top 5 at 5.
Don't be that guy.
That's right. Don't be that guy. We say it every week. You don't want to be that guy. You don't want to be that gal. You don't want to be a group of people who are doing something that compels you to say to the person next to you, yeah, you don't want to be that guy. You don't want to be that guy or gal. We usually go to the state of Florida for this. Sometimes we go to Alabama or Arkansas. We've traveled up to Maine. We've been to New York. Last week we went to London. This time, for the first time, we'd like to welcome Honolulu, Hawaii, to the Christopher Gabriel program as this week's entrant in Don't Be That Guy. And we always tell you, we don't make these stories up. This was on the AP. You can look it up yourself. All right, so this is according to KHON-TV and being reported by the Associated Press that the U.S. Postal Service in Honolulu has found mail that was stolen in Hawaii more than 10 years ago. And the way they're going to recognize this, or I should say rectify this, is they are going to, in the next couple of days, the Postal Service in Hawaii is going to get a hold of all the stolen mail and send it back to wherever they can, either to the addresses that it didn't go to or the addresses that the mail came from. The mail dates back about 13 to 15 years ago. Stolen mail was mostly first class and priority mail. Now, they are quick to point out that they are not or have not yet identified the postal worker on his or her route that the stolen mail came from. That would be helpful. Most of the mail belonged to people living in the downtown Honolulu area. But here is your key point in this story. The Postal Service said that not to worry, don't be concerned, it's been 13 to 15 years. However, the mail will have a label on it explaining the delay and a number to call. A couple things about that. Number one, what is the label going to say? Sorry, 13 years ago, 14 years ago, 15 years ago, this piece of mail was stolen. And we're sorry. We just found it. We're now mailing it back. If you'd like to talk with us about it, you can call us at 888-555-1212 or whatever the number is. What is that discussion going to be about? The mail is 13 to 15 years old. A bill, a love letter, a cancellation notice of service, whatever it is, those things have all been rectified. What is that conversation going to be about? What number is being provided? What customer service agent at the U.S. Postal Service office in Honolulu, or two people, or three, what are they going to be saying? Can you imagine? You already get delays at post offices in large cities. Honolulu, I mean, you're talking lines. Can you imagine calling? Your wait time today, Bobby, is 1 hour and 37 minutes. And you're going to get somebody on there that's going to say, U.S. Postalers, may I help you? Yeah, I just got my letter that was sent to me from my mom. It was a nice letter from 14 years ago, and said I could call and talk about it. How did this happen? What is she going to say? What is she going to say? Heaven's sakes. All right. Coming up, we're going to switch gears here. And we're get far more serious. We're going to talk with Tori Lindley, president of the National Athletic Trainers Association. He's also the senior associate athletic director for health, safety, and performance at Northwestern University. This is the CGP.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Final half hour of the program here on Wednesday. Glad to have you aboard. One of the things that we talk about on this program a lot is the power that college coaches, football and basketball in particular, have over their campuses, their communities, not only in the particular athletic team and that environment, but in terms of the clout that they have. And one area, and we've discussed this a number of times, one area that they do have a certain amount of influence is in the medical area. And it presents a very interesting dynamic of players who get injured and how fast they should come back versus how fast they do come back. Tori Lindley is the president of the National Athletic Trainers Association, and I believe he is also the senior associate athletic director for health, safety, and performance at Northwestern University. Mr. Lindley joins me right now. Tori, how are you, sir?
Christopher, I'm fantastic. Thank you for having me.
And are you at Northwestern, are you not?
I am. I'm not currently. We're in Las Vegas right now, right, for our national symposium and convention. But yes, I am. I am proud to be a healthcare provider at Northwestern University.
I only asked that because I grew up in Rogers Park. So
you did?
Yes, I
did.
So I have a long association as a kid going up to games at Northwestern. So when I saw that and I saw the purple and white next to your name, I thought that was pretty cool.
And why would you ever leave?
Well, that's a long story. I get back whenever I can. Chicago is my home and always will be my home. Tori, can we get a baseline first? For everybody listening, I want you to explain the difference between athletic trainers and trainers.
Oh, it's a drastic difference. So athletic trainers are primary health care providers who focus and specialize in the prevention, the assessment, the diagnosis of injury and illness, and then work very strong with their patients and their student athletes or their clients in rehabilitation, recovery, and return to sport, return to life, return to play. And probably the biggest thing that differentiates athletic trainers from other allied health is the focus on prevention, risk mitigation, and injury reduction. And then probably the area that you're alluding to is the difference between a personal trainer, someone, you know, who doesn't have the same or any medical expertise or background, no medical education, who's maybe helping someone become more fit or whatever their goals might be at a gym. Athletic trainers are healthcare providers. Our degree is a master's level degree, and we are board certified by an independent body and licensed in many, many, many states.
The reason I wanted you to do that, I know that there's some people driving around here in the area, wherever they're listening to us around the country, it might seem like a pedestrian question, but the reality is athletic trainers, and this is the subject of our discussion today, they are at the top of their field wanting the very best, to provide the very best health care for student athletes, correct?
You are exactly correct.
So a recent survey shows that 19% of college athletic trainers reporting that a coach played an athlete who was deemed medically out of participation. Now, you overheard me certainly at the beginning saying this is a topic that's come up many times in my program. Let's start here. Tori, how much pressure do athletic trainers in the NCAA, let's focus on Division I schools like yours at Northwestern. How much pressure are they under to rush athletes back in terms of looking for the greater good from the coach's standpoint of wins and losses?
Christopher, the stat that you gave is one that we really were surprised to find. It's a stat that demonstrates that the work that the NCAA and the NATA have done to push forward both policy guidelines and now legislation that provides institutions with the opportunity to create an environment where there is medical autonomy, where an independent medical model is provided so that student-athlete health and safety is prioritized. So, you know, to have that finding for us from an athletic training perspective was really surprising. The reality is there are a number of situations where coaches and departments are hand-in-hand with athletic trainers in prioritizing health and safety. But when you bring up the thoughts of a competitive environment, you bring up the thoughts of, you know, as an athletic trainer, as a healthcare provider, when you look to your left and look to your right, and if you see a coach or an administrator that you view to be your boss or your supervisor or the person that's evaluating you, perhaps even making decisions on hiring and firing, and that person is not a healthcare provider, then there's the potential for that influence, whether it's direct or indirect, for a healthcare provider maybe to make a decision that's not in the best interest. And then there's that extreme, which, you know, you cited as 19%, where even if not cleared, a coach returned or made the choice to return someone to play. So concern for sure, but this really isn't, you know, an AT versus a coach type thing. This is an institution and an NCAA member organization opportunity for independent medical care to be prioritized.
And I would tell you, I would add to that, that's very well spoken, that for somebody who is, myself, completely ignorant to where these numbers should be, when I saw that number, it's kind of like you see something and say, that can't be right. That's just too high. So I'm not surprised by your reaction. Folks, we're talking with Tori Lindley, the president of the National Athletic Trainers Association. So about 3 years ago, somewhere about there, I feel like I remember the NCAA passing legislation that effectively prohibited coaches or athletic directors from having any influence on how fast an athlete was returning when he or she was coming back from an injury. Has that legislation, am I remembering that right, Tori? And if so, has that legislation been ignored or is it being ignored?
I don't believe it's being ignored at all, and we don't believe that. You know, NATA, as I said, is very proud of the work that NCAA has done and continues to do. You know, the fact that there is legislation and policy in place now is much different and a much bigger and more important step than creating recommendations. And I think we're really at a turning point. There's a number of institutions that have instituted, publicly talked about the institution of an independent medical model, and there's a number of ways in which, Christopher, your broadcast today alone helps by raising awareness of the understanding of an entire department taking on a culture of student-athlete health and safety first, developing a structure that supports that, and then most importantly, functioning in a way that the healthcare provider is the ultimate authority. That primary athletics healthcare provider, the athletic trainer, and the team physician are able to utilize their clinical expertise to do what's absolutely best for every single student-athlete. So 19% has to be 0%. It absolutely has to.
So then, based upon your experience and certainly the years that you have in this, do you believe that a coach, I don't care if it's Nick Saban or Chip Kelly at UCLA or Pat Fitzgerald up in Evanston, should a coach be able to have influence on the hiring or firing of sports medicine personnel or their staffs?
Same type of thing. There are many coaches. In fact, I would probably figure that most coaches have no interest in that type of decision-making, the hiring and the firing. And that's exactly where the legislation, the policy comes into play, indicating to institutions that it's critically important that they create a structure where the coach or the administration is separated from that process. And then further, in the day-to-day evaluation of a healthcare provider, in the day-to-day, week-to-week, and then annual evaluation of their skill set and their execution of all the things I talked about before, that should be evaluated by another healthcare provider. So simply aligning the athletic training staff more firmly under the supervision of the team physician, because every college and university has a team physician, and offering the team physician that opportunity, not an administrator, which is in many situations, it's an administrator. In very few situations, is it a coach? But, you know, this legislation is really put in place to prevent those situations where, as you determined, as you mentioned earlier, that a coach would come into a new job and say, you know what, I cannot succeed unless I have, air quotes, my own medical staff, my own athletic trainer. That's a situation, that's a structure and a function that is set up to fail.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned structure. Folks, we're talking with Tori Lindley, president of National Athletic Trainers Association. I'm glad you mentioned that, because we use the word culture a lot in sports, and I've always believed that culture in virtually any environment stems in many ways from structure, or in this case, a team's structure. So does the structure, having team doctors, team athletic trainers, does it hinder the objectivity and decision-making ability of those medical personnel to make a decision that essentially, Tori, puts health and well-being first?
It absolutely should not. And we're talking a lot about the Division I, which is what happens when you flip on your television. But let me get personal very quickly. My son is a Division III athlete. And as a parent of an NCAA athlete, I can't tell you how important it is that I know that this occurs at his institution. And I know that no matter what happens, that decision-making is done without this feeling of influence from anybody other, you know, outside of the medical staff and the medical team of athletic trainers and physicians. So, you know, really what that means is we expect and have ongoing conversations with coaches as athletic trainers every single day, regardless of sport. And those conversations we talk about player availability. We talk about expected return to play. We talk about progress and really, you know, just give, you know, updates on where things are at. We share information because our student athletes allow us to. When there's questions about status, that's different than when there's questioning. When there's questioning in those rooms, that's when the athletic trainer may feel like there is unnecessary, or that there's pressure, which is certainly unnecessary, to think that, you know, maybe they push them back a little too quickly. So, you know, as an organization, NATA is obviously focused and prioritizes health and safety first and foremost, and we want to do everything we can do to support our members to do exactly what's best, because every student athlete is someone's son or daughter.
And we want to make sure we point that out, that what NATA does, and correct me if I misspeak, part of what you do is to ensure that the best health care is being provided to student athletes across the country, correct?
Yeah, frontline health care providers for life and sport is kind of our tagline. So in this case, we're talking about sports. So no further than Fresno State University, a talented team of athletic trainers, regardless of sport, typically for most sports, and we'll stick with football, are on the sidelines every day, regardless of the activity. So all football practices, of course, all football games, of course, the level of healthcare that Fresno State, their sports medicine team, delivers on game day is probably something that most people would have no idea what goes into that and what great care that those student athletes are getting. But it's also at practices, it's also at workouts, it's conditioning. And this is some of the areas in which new legislation that we're, again, very proud of the NCAA for what's coming up, future legislation and policy enacted on August 1st, because, you know, we've just seen too many student athletes dying not playing football, too many student athletes dying not playing their sport, but dying preparing for their sport. And so medical autonomy, medical decision making, and extending that and reinforcing it for healthcare providers, but also creating new chain of command and new reporting so that information can also be shared around the area of the conditioning side of things, so that there's a much more safe environment for our student athletes and our most precious commodity. So that's what happens, and that's kind of the reality of it day to day. And to be able to execute that without any type of pressure is where this survey kind of indicates that we've got work to do, but there's a lot of really good situations out there that we need to build on as far as best practices. University of Kansas being one of them.
I want to talk about them because in May they removed their strength and conditioning staff from being under the auspices or the supervision of the athletic department, and they now report or will report through the University of Kansas health system. Are they stepping out and doing something that's just not usually done? And will do you hope that more schools will look at this as a structure that should be followed?
The tide is changing. We know that. We see that. We applaud the University of Kansas for this step. They're probably not the first, but I'm really thrilled that they were willing to be out front in terms of, you know, being proud of this, being proud of a structure and screaming from the mountaintops how important that they feel that this is for their student athletes. So, yes, it is what we expect to be a trend that, you know, maybe didn't start in Lawrence, but it certainly has helped to start a really important conversation, kind of like we're having right now. And we expect other institutions to realize, okay, there's a Power 5, Autonomy 5 school who competes at a very high level in a number of different sports, who have really focused and shined a light on the importance of health and safety and the independence that goes into promoting health and safety.
So, Tori, if there are athletic trainers at a university and they see things within this structure going on, or they believe that questions, inappropriate questions, are being asked or demands are being made by a coach or a coaching staff relative to getting that student athlete back on the field or the court or the ice surface before he or she is ready, how do these athletic trainers speak up without fear of losing their job?
So, Christopher, I hope you've learned a little bit today, and wow, I really appreciate the extended time, but based on what I've told you, the answer is something you should know. They should be able to report that directly to their supervisor, and their supervisor should be a team physician. Their supervisor should not be an athletics administrator necessarily, because of the opportunity for the athletics administrator, who's also working directly with the coach and trying to have an opportunity to help coaches succeed. So, you know, if coach success is connected directly to, and the same person has oversight over someone who's trying to succeed in providing great care, great health, and great safety, and trying to prevent these things, that's exactly where the structure comes into play. And so they need to be able to turn to a healthcare provider and say, listen, I've got this sense that, and there's a direct feeling that this student athlete isn't coming back fast enough, or this athlete is not tough enough, or this athlete is maybe faking this injury and maybe questioning the healthcare provider, the athletic trainer face-to-face, then that AT should be able to turn to the team doc and say, this is an issue, please help me. And then the team physician, in turn, should let them know that you're safe, you're protected, you report to me, and as a team physician, I've got your back, and you and we have a plan of care that we will continue to execute, and that plan of care will prioritize the health and safety. So on those rare occasions where that happens, that's exactly what the AT should be able to do.
That's great. Again, very well said. Last thing for you, and I appreciate you taking some time out of your early evening to join us today. You said you're the father of a Division III athlete. So for parents who are listening to us, and we're a very sports-conscious area here in the Central Valley, obviously produces a lot of student-athletes around the country at all the division levels. What would you counsel parents to be looking for and doing when they visit schools and their kids are being recruited relative to the athletic trainer part of it?
Sure. If they're fortunate to be in that situation and they have a high-level student who's a potential student athlete, then questions on recruiting visits and through email should absolutely be of the nature to investigate what their healthcare model is. Ask them about independent medical decision making. Ask them about independent medical care. Ask them who the athletic trainers report to. Those are simple questions. Those things can be delivered in a really, pretty passive manner, and it's not confrontational, and it's it's something that I think you and I both would agree that's a lot more important than tell me how many different helmets you offer my son on Saturday and alternate uniforms. Student athletes are dying. They're dying preparing to play sport, and that's absolutely preventable, and it absolutely has to change.
This is terrific stuff. Folks, he is Tory Lindley, president of the National Athletic Trainers Association. He's also senior associate athletic director for health, safety, and performance at the terrific school we call Northwestern up in Evanston, Illinois. Tory, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your early evening to join us. I thank the folks who helped me put this together as well. It's been enlightening, and it's been very educational.
Christopher, I can't thank you enough. Most talk show hosts will not take this opportunity, so I'm available for you whenever, and not just because you're a Rogers Park guy. So we're proud of what NATA is doing, so thrive on NATA and go Cats.
I appreciate that, and we will definitely look you up again. Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you.
Absolutely. Tory Lindley, that is good stuff. One more thing is next. Shorter show today, but gave you some good stuff. Tory Lindley was just fantastic. Really enjoyed him coming on. He'll be back on the program again at some point down the line. Also, my thanks to Marty Lenz. Bobby, last couple of days, man, doing a great job.
Thank you, Christopher.
Seriously,
had a blast.
No surprise. No surprise at all. You are just one of the many very talented people that are in this building that don't always get mentioned, but should get mentioned. It's Bobby Thistle. Does a great job. Folks, we are back with a full program tomorrow. We will see you in 21 hours. Until then, you are on your own.
Your home of the San Francisco Giants, 940 ESPN, the Valley's local sports leader, KFIG Fresno.